Continue our considerations on game theory. And, well, once again with the other beamer, because this one just won't accept anything from this remote control. Why should he? I mean, if it's also possible to not accept anything, it's certainly cooler to do so. So, that is all the stuff that we had. So, I think that's basically where we left off, if I'm not completely mistaken. So, having introduced the notation, I'm starting. Hi. Show is going on now, this very present moment, now. Okay, cool. Perfect. So that's where we left off, and we basically introduced notational aspects from the Fudenberg-Tirol book. I'm not completely sure whether I already uploaded the game theory materials, which I should do right away. Okay. So, having used this game theory or this payoff matrix as an example for the notation, we ended up with asking ourselves, how can we actually tell what's going on here? What's the Nash equilibrium? And the reasoning that's on the left side of the slide made us believe that UL in that case is a strict Nash equilibrium, which it is, and the process of arriving there, this process of reasoning, is called iterated strict dominance. Okay, and once again, this type of reasoning cannot be applied to all game theory or payoff matrices, not to all games, but once it can be applied, we can find the Nash equilibrium, or in this case, the unique Nash equilibrium with that strategy. And we'll see other examples of this presumably later. Okay, good. And this is also something that we found or thought it was clear that this iterated strict dominance does not depend on the elimination order, okay? So, and that's because of the fact that if something is larger than something else out of a set, then it would be larger than something else out of a subset of this. So we can start pretty much anywhere and arrive at the same Nash equilibrium, okay? Good. So, and prisoner's dilemma, if I'm not completely mistaken, yeah, that's also something. No, that's not something we already discussed. Not sure whether we already had prisoner's dilemma, but this we will cover on later. So, prisoner's dilemma, we had this reasoning of minimum guaranteed payoff, which is just a variant of this iterated strict dominance reasoning. So prisoner's dilemma can also be solved via iterated strict dominance. Okay, good. So, and what we already saw is, okay, we have pure strategies, so choosing exactly one of the action options with probability one and not choosing the others. And we also had these mixed strategies, where a player, yeah, well, randomizes, yeah, and chooses each of his action options with a certain probability that are supposed to add up to one. And we emphasized that it is not the case that you would make your calculations with respect to one of the outcomes only, but what you do with respect or in regard to the utilities is that you compute expectations, right? So that does not mean that you, in essence, does not mean that you perform this game repeatedly, because that's in essence something different from a logical point of view, but you do the game once, all the players choose their actions at a time, but you would compute the expectation of this one-time execution of the game, right? So that's a bit of a logical difference. Remember the Axelrod stuff and the prisoner's dilemma. So a repeated execution of the game is something different than computing expectations. Okay, good. Now, another game, let's give ourselves the cursor. Good, thank you. Now, this is the first player, and this is the second player, and we'll always stick to that, okay? So the first player has the options up, middle, down, and the other one left or right. And certainly, for the first player M, the strategy M is not dominated by U, and it's also not dominated by D. Why? So 2 is larger than 0, but minus 1 is smaller than 0. Minus 1 is smaller than 0, but 2 is larger than 0. So it's not the case that D dominates M. It's also not the case that U dominates M. Okay. However, if we let player 1 play a mixed strategy where he plays U with probability 1/2, M with probability 0, and D with probability 1/2, what he will get is a expected payoff from this strategy of 1/2, okay? And that's regardless of how player 2 plays. While when playing M, he would get a payoff of 0, okay? So that pure strategy M would give him 0, whereas combining U and M, or randomizing over U and M in that in that fashion, would give him a payoff of 1/2. So, and you might have already read this, a pure strategy, in this case M, can be dominated by a mixed strategy, even if it is not strictly dominated by any pure strategy, right? So if someone might have suspected that, that's not the case, right? And this is just an example for that, okay? Good. Now, a bit more notation, which is more like a, well, instantiating what we had in the notational slides with a bit more, well, with a bit more consequence, okay? So what we will normally do is we will discuss the options that one player I has when we hold the other player's options fixed, okay? So that's something we do, for example, when discussing what a Nash equilibrium is, and we said that this minus I stands for the set of all the other players, okay? So S minus I out of the set of strategies minus I is the stuff that the other players play, okay? So it's typical if we have a short notation that goes like this. So I as player I play S prime, then the other players play S minus I. And this S minus I stands for S1, S2, S and so forth, SI minus 1, and then I am as player I come into play, I play S prime I, and then the other players play their stuff. Then, not in the sense of temporarily then, but, well, then in the sense of the following rest of the players, okay? Typically, we have two-player games, so the strategy of the other players is just reduces to the strategy of the other player, okay? That's just a notation. And what we can do for pure strategies is also possible for mixed strategies, right? Just exactly the same stuff. So, now, taking up our definition from the first part, which is about domination, what we have here again is that a pure strategy as I is said to be strictly dominated for player I if some alternative exists such that the gain of player I, or the reward or the utility, is strictly larger than when player I plays this SI. So SI is strictly dominated if there is an alternative, sigma I prime, such that this inequation holds. And it's important that it holds for all the alternatives that the other players might play, right? So if that inequation is just true for some other player's behavior and for other players behave for some other other's behavior, it is not true, then there is no domination, right? And that is especially important for this technique of iterated strict dominance, okay? We can only apply this if some strategy is dominating, okay? Now, you might ask yourselves, why are we talking here about pure strategies? And here we're talking about a mixed strategy. Well, okay, first of all, we see that a mixed strategy can also be a pure strategy, right? If it's a pure strategy, it's just some special mixed strategy. And sorry, the reason why we only check here for pure strategies will become clear in a moment, okay? And the same notation is also be possible if you replace the larger than sign with a larger or equal sign. And then we speak of the fact that the strategy SI is weakly dominated if such an alternative sigma I prime exists. Okay, and it's necessary that the exact sign holds for at least one of the other players' alternatives. Okay, good. So, that's that, okay? Now, first of all, we might ask ourselves, why do we only check for other players' pure strategies, okay? Why don't we say for all sigma minus I element of sigma, large sigma minus I, okay? So we only check here for pure strategy alternatives on behalf of the other players, okay? And the reason is that if this inequation holds, this inequation for the mixed strategy other players' alternatives also holds. And why is that? Because this utility function is a convex function of the mixing probabilities. Okay? And that's why the inequalities hold also. If you prove that the inequality holds for the basic directions, yeah, it will also hold for a convex combination. Okay, that's just the nature of convexity. Okay, and that's what makes our lives easy, right? So we don't have to check for all possible weird mixed strategy, other players' alternatives. What we only need to check is all the pure strategy, other players' alternatives. So what's a convex function? That just to remember that. So a convex function is a function that here I forgot the x-axis, sorry. In that case, yeah, it is the t-axis if you want. So t is, no, is it true? Let me just check. F of x, whatever you might call this axis here of the running variable, right? So this is the point x, and this is the point y. And here we have f of x, and here we have f of y. I should probably put these things in here as well, right? And so a strictly convex function is always below the straight line connecting the respective points f of x and f of y, okay? So this is the equation for the straight line here on the right side of the inequality. It is linear in t, right? So t is the interpolation parameter. And since it's linear in t and it interpolates from f of x to f of y, Yeah. So if t is 0, we start, sorry, if t is 1, we start at f of x, and if t is 0, we end at f of y, right? So this is an interpolation. It's linear, so it's the equation of this linear piece. And here we're asking ourselves, what is the function value if we interpolate smoothly linearly between x and y? And that's just f of this linear interpolation, right? And this inequation just tells us that the function is always below the straight line alternative, okay? And if you think that through, which we're not going to do in all detail, you would see that this convex function property of the utility function is sufficient for that statement. Okay, good. So that's just our definition, strict domination. Okay, and we're only checking here for our own pure alternatives. Okay, and we will see what happens for dominated mixed strategies, okay? And that's the point here, okay? So, here we were talking about dominated strict strategies, and for that we would accept if there is a mixed strategy alternative, okay? Now, what if we consider mixed strategies that are dominated, okay? So, what is easy to see is that if we have a mixed strategy that randomizes over pure strategies that are themselves dominated, this mixed strategy must be dominated. So that's the easy case number A. Okay. But you could ask yourself, well, is it maybe the other way around? But that's also not the case. A mixed strategy may be dominated even if it assigns positive probabilities to those pure strategies that are not dominated, not even weakly dominated. Okay, why is that the case? Okay, so let's check this. So player 1 again, player 2 here on the to the right, player 1 up and down. So U and M are not dominated by D for player 1. Why? So 0 is larger than minus 2, but 0 is smaller than 1. And 0 is smaller than 1, but larger than minus 2. So U and M are not dominated by D. Okay. However, if we randomize over those pure strategies that are not dominated, what we get is a utility of minus 1/2 for the first player, no matter what the other player does. Okay? So if we randomize, we see from these values, if you compute the expectation, you would always get minus 1/2. Okay? However, if you play D, right, what you would get is a payoff of 0. For sure, no matter what the other player does. And 0 is strictly larger than minus 2. So we see that a mixed strategy that puts his bet on strategies that are not dominated in any way can be dominated itself, right? So it is... in that sense, not the other way around is not clear. However, what is easy is that if it bets on dominated pure strategies, it will be dominated itself. Good. Now, all this game theory type of reasoning is bound to strict rationality, meaning that the only goal of the players is to maximize their utility on the one hand, and this on the second hand, they would only pay heed to those arguments that are rational. So no psychology involved, only math. Okay? Now, if you regard this matrix, what you find is if you apply iterated strict dominance, you see that UL is a strict Nash equilibrium. Okay? How can we see that? Okay. So, let's apply this. So 10 is strictly larger than 9. 6 is strictly larger than 5. So the second player will not play R, but will play L. So the first player knows this, and he would then only have to check his gain alternatives for L, and he would see that U, in this case, is larger than D. 8 is larger than 7. Okay? So, and he would play U for sure, since that reasoning applies. So UL is UL is a pure strategy Nash equilibrium, right? And that we found via this iterated strict dominance type of argument. Now, if you regard this matrix in more detail, you would see that if I'm player 1 and I play U, I would surely gain 8, right? Because that's a Nash equilibrium, and the other one would gain 10. Now, psychology dictates that you can never be sure about people, right? So these ultimatum game experiments show that moral, in a sense, is overlaid on top of our reasoning processes, such that, for example, we're not willing to accept a unfair proposal by the other player, for example, even if the alternative of not accepting it would give us a gain of 0, right? And that's just morally induced. That's a social function, because we're bound in our social functions to not only optimize our own utility, but to adhere to moral rules very strictly, because those moral rules ensure our survival in society. Okay? So if all the individuals are just rational, society couldn't work as such. But there is no such thing as moral or society in game theory, right? So you can never be sure about people. Okay? So the second player might, in some mood, decide to play R. While it's not rational, he or she might do so. And then player one is really bad off, because he or she would get minus 100. So he might decide to play D instead, because he would reason, okay, it's rational for the second player to play L, okay, and while with U I get 8, with D I would only get 1 less. Okay, so D is in a sense safer with respect to small perturbations from rationality. And that's something that for agents and robots may play a lesser role than for true games or for social computing. Because in social computing and social games, the only thing you do, you model interactions with the help of game theory. Yeah, but still the underlying processes are human processes. Okay, good. So that's that. Now, once again, as a repetition, what's the difference between game theory and decision theory? So seemingly, what we do is the same. So we're trying to optimize utility functions. We're trying to find maxima of utility functions. And that's the same that you would do in decision theory as well. And even if you include probability, yeah, you would do the same. You would compute expectations, right? However, in decision theory, it is nature that makes moves, right? So it's nature that kind of gambles and brings about a certain state of the environment with certain probabilities. And then you computer expectation with respect to your estimation of those probabilities. But the only other player is nature, and nature is unimpressed by what you decide. Okay, so if I say the probability of rain is 0.8 and the probability of sunshine is 0.2, and if I'm to decide whether I'm going to play basketball or whether I'm working in my office, the decision would be work in the office, because the expectation of rain just outweighs that if I substitute proper utility functions, right? But nature is totally unimpressed when it comes to deciding upon rain or sunshine by my decision whether to work or not, right? This is trivial. However, in game theory, we have many decision makers. And that's what makes this so complicated and so subtle, right? So at the moment, we had only rather trivial reasonings, but the reasonings in game theory can be subtle. So let's look at an example, okay? So in this game here, if we apply our principle of iterated strict dominance, which I have to emphasize is not possible to apply for all such matrices, but in this case it is, we would find that again UL is the Nash equilibrium. Okay. Now, what happens? If player 1 would reduce her payoff by a factor of 2, right? So my 1 would be a minus 1, and 4 would be a 2, and we would reduce this payoff only for our action U up, okay? What would happen? So in decision theory, if whatever my utilities for basketball or for playing are, if I reduce them by a constant amount, nothing different will come out, okay? So in decision theory, it just makes no difference. It's of no use, in a sense. But in game theory, the reduction of payoff, although it's uniform for U, would result in a new Nash equilibrium, namely DR now. Okay. So, and what we see is that in UL, we had a gain of 1 as player 1. And if I reduce my utility, I would now end up in a Nash equilibrium where I gain 3. And that's something strange that cannot happen in decision theory. Because in decision theory, as I said, the probabilities are not influenced by my decision. Okay? Good. Now, as I announced in the beginning, prisoner's dilemma. Now, this is a different matrix than we had in the first part, but it's a good example of seeing that the game is still identical because the respective preference relations are the same. So it doesn't matter if you multiply this by a factor of 10 or if you change the absolute numbers in a way that the relations are kept. Okay, so this is exactly the same game. And now let's try iterated strict dominance. Okay, so what we have for player 2 is that 2 is strictly larger than 1 and 0 is strictly larger than minus 1. Okay, good. So that's certainly true. Now, I'm thinking. Is that the right matrix? Because what would happen then would be, he would certainly, yes, okay, it's the right matrix. Okay, since 2 is larger than 1 and 0 is larger than minus 1, the second player is guaranteed to not play C, right? He or she will play D. And since the first player knows this, he would only have to think about this. So, and 0 is strictly larger than minus 1. So we end up at DD being the Nash equilibrium, right? So that's the exact basically exact same reasoning. However, with iterated strict dominance, it's maybe more clear what happens. Okay? And again, it doesn't depend on the relation, on the starting point. So I could as well have started with player one and would have applied the same reasoning and ended up in this Nash equilibrium, yeah, to defect. Now let's look at a different example. So some games are not necessarily well represented by a game theory matrix, okay? And a good example is auctions, okay? And auctions are also used in multi-agent scenarios and other structured, resource allocation scenarios and things. An auction, I think, is pretty clear. There are bidders and there's an auctioneer. And there's several mechanisms or several variants of how the auction is going about. So dimensions that you can use to classify auctions are which price has to be paid. Okay, first price auctions have to pay the price that the actual bidder bid it. Second price auctions, surprisingly, there the winner has to pay the bid of the second highest, bidder. Okay, then there's the decision upon who wins, and for example, usually auctions are conducted in a way that the one with the highest bid wins. Okay, now you can also have axes like whether the auction is ascending. As the typical auction, is there anybody else that wants to bid more? No, okay, 1, 2, 3, yours. And decreasing auctions are, for example, used in the Netherlands when flowers are auctioned, right? So the price is lowered until someone says, bingo, I'm going to do it. And it, very many of these are around. And one of them is a Vickrey auction. So that's a one-shot auction. So all the bidders submit their bids, right? And there is no raising the bids or something. They submit their bids in secret. And the winner is the one with the highest bid. Okay? That's simple enough. But interesting is that the winner only has to pay the price of the second highest bid. And that appears a bit strange, and we will see why this is a good idea. Okay, good. So, what we assume is that everybody has a certain valuation for the good that's currently being auctioned. Any player bids a bid, and that's small si. And with ri, we will denote the price that has to be paid, and in Vickrey auction, this is the maximum of all the other players when we assume that I'm the one that wins. Okay, so the winning condition is my bid is the largest bid among all the bids, so it's especially larger than all the other players' bids. And the price I have to pay is exactly the maximum of all the other players' bids. So that's the second highest bid that's in the game. Okay? Because I'm the winner, I have the highest bid, and the maximum of the other players is the second highest. And that's my price, RI, that I have to pay. Right? And the valuation can be different for all the players. Right? So if your grandpa's old socks are auctioned, you might have a high valuation for your grandpa's old socks, whereas I haven't. Okay, so it's like an estimate of how much this thing is of value for you. And naturally, the winner's utility is the valuation minus the price he or she has to pay, right? And we assume that valuations and prices and bids are all in the same units of measurement, yeah, like money or utility points or something. Yeah, let's say it's money, not utility points. Okay, good. And all the others have a utility of zero because they lose. Okay, so let's check what the Nash equilibrium is, and let's check why this is the case. So the statement is that for each player, it is the weekly dominant strategy to bid their true valuations. And why is that interesting? Okay, gambling is the behavior where people behave in a game, an auction, or a market in such a way that they pretend to be interested in something, whereas in real life they're not actually interested in that. Just, for example, to manipulate prices and to make other people do something else, and so on and so on. So in bidding, it's clear that a possible strategy would be in a normal English auction, which is ascending and first price, it could be that you try to bid with someone that you perceive to be very interested in a good, just to cause negative effects on him, right? So you raise the price while in real life you're not even interested in the good. So that's a risky behavior because you might end up winning, but still it is you pursuing some weird goal. Okay, so that's something that is in many Hollywood films having to do with auctions, right? But the goal would be a fair auction, would be the one where everybody bids according to his or her true valuation. So, well, the one that wins is the one that has the highest valuation, and that's only fair, okay? So it's good that victory auctions have this type of Nash equilibrium. And why is this the case? So what we have to do is we have to analyze the respective cases. So here we have the number arrow, right? So things more to the right mean larger. And the first case is why is it not rational to overbid? Why is it not rational that your bid is larger than your valuation? Yeah, so your bid is larger than your valuation. So if RI is larger than SI, okay, what will happen is that I, as player I, will not win the auction because my bid is not the highest bid, right? Since RI is the maximum of all the other players' bids. So RI is larger than SI. In this case, I lose, so my utility is zero. So I could have bidden my true valuation as well. So my SI could have been equal to VI. So there's no change. If RI is smaller or equal than VI, right, what happens is I win, yeah, because my bid is higher than the second highest bid, and my utility, but my utility is still only VI minus RI, this difference. So I could have bidden VI from the start, wouldn't have changed my utility. Okay, good. So overbidding is not does not give me anything. In these cases, it also doesn't hurt, right? So that's why we only consider this strategy as weakly dominant. But however, it is, well, not a dominating strategy. Now, in the case that RI is just in between VI and SI, and that's the last case for overbidding, right? Then what happens is that I actually win because SI is larger than RI, but my utility is still VI minus RI, which in this case is negative, right? So what I'm suffering is the winner's curse. So since I overbid it and the second highest bid is larger than my true valuation, what I did was I kind of spoiled the game. and I'm punished by the winner's curse. So if I had bidden, my SI would have been VI, then I would have lost, and the RI bidder would have won, which is okay, right? And then my utility would have been zero at last and not negative. So that's the danger of overbidding. Let's say if I want to bid for a car that's worth 10,000 for me, and I bid 2 million and I win, well, I'm worse off than if I had just bidden and lost. And underbidding is also not rational, which is maybe more clear, since, for example, if RI is smaller or equal than SI, or RI is larger than VI, that's the second case, my utility is unchanged if I would have bidden SI equal to my VI, right? And if RI is just in between SI and VI, I forgo a positive winning chance by this underbidding behavior, right? So again, my utility is not changed by this underbidding behavior. It even has negative consequences. Now, and all these things that we considered were under the assumption that everybody knows valuations, but since these considerations do not strictly depend on the actual valuation itself, because in no case it is rational to not bid your true valuation, we can drop this and say that bidding your own valuation is weakly dominant for each player, right? And that's something where we now analyzed a game-like interaction. Yeah, so it's not a multi-stage game, it's a one-stage game. Everybody submits her bids at a time. And we don't have a game theory matrix here, which we could do with a certain amount of work, but in this case, this analysis is maybe more convenient. Now, we already used the term Nash equilibrium while not having formally defined it in that notation. Okay, so let's do this. So a Nash equilibrium would be a strategy profile such that each player's strategy is the optimal response to all possible other players' strategies, or the optimal response to all the other players' strategies in that Nash equilibrium, which is maybe more correct, right? So a Nash equilibrium is a strategy profile, a action for each of the players, right? Such that my action is the optimal response to the other players' actions in the Nash equilibrium. More formally, sigma star is a Nash equilibrium if, for all the players, this inequation holds, namely that my utility, when I play according to the Nash equilibrium, is larger or equal than all the other utilities that would occur if I played any other pure strategy alternative. Okay? So, in a sense, sigma I star is my optimal response to what the other players play. Sigma star minus I. Okay, because my utility is larger or equal than it all those variants where I would play a pure strategy something else. Okay. Of course, if sigma I is not a true mixed strategy, but a degenerate mixed or a pure strategy, it's also possible. It's just the same definition, and we call this then a pure strategy Nash equilibrium. Okay? We call this a strict Nash equilibrium if it's a Nash equilibrium in that sense, and for all the players, we would have a larger sign here, right? For, in this case, strict strategies that would maximize the utility. Okay. What you can see is that a strict Nash equilibrium is necessarily a pure strategy Nash equilibrium. Okay. Good. And the question is, well, that's the definition from here. Once again, why do we only have to check for pure strategy alternatives? Okay. Well, it's because the expected utilities are linear in the mixing probabilities. So that's sufficient for only having to check for pure own alternatives. Once we proved that this is true for all own pure alternatives, then we can say it's a Nash equilibrium. Okay. Another consequence of this is that in a true mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, meaning it's non-degenerate, not non-pure, it has a true probability distribution, right? What we would have then is that a player in the Nash equilibrium must be indifferent with respect to all pure strategies that he or she assigns a positive probability to, right? And that's called the indifference condition. Now, that's something we will get examples for. Now, the question is, why is that the case? What do these things mean? Okay, so let's check it. So if, let's say, we have a player that's up, middle, down, he has these three possibilities. And let's assume we have a probability P1, 0, P2. And these are non-equal to 0. So that's a true non-degenerate mixed strategy. And let's assume it's in... It's part of the Nash equilibrium, right? So my part of the Nash equilibrium. And the indifference condition means that although P1 can be different than P2, utility-wise, I must be indifferent to the utility resulting from U or D. Okay? So there is a utility here. In the matrix, and this utility, this expected utility that comes out. So there is more things like that. Yeah. So this is X2, or let's make it clear. So we have left and right, for example, right. So this is a game theory matrix, right? And we have some utility U of UL, right? And here we have. So U1, right? So, since I'm player one, and that's here is player two, yeah. And I'm having U1 of UR and so on, right? In all these things, and my expectation that results when I play U must be the same as when D occurs, right? We will see examples for this. Why is this the case? So let's check it. Okay. So my utility, I'm player I, and a mixed strategy is played. Yeah. Then my utility is computed as an expectation, and the expectation is taken over all the pure strategy outcomes of my own alternatives, right? So taken all over all the SI of my strategy space, yeah? And I would have to compute them with respect to what the other players do and with respect to my own mixing coefficients, right? That's just how I would compute my expectation. And in the Nash equilibrium, the same equation holds, okay? Certainly. So this is for a general mixed strategy profile, and in the Nash equilibrium mixed strategy profile, the same equation holds. I just put a star on each sigma, right? So no difference. But what we know is that, in a sense, UI of the Nash equilibrium is the best outcome for me, Yeah, because it's my best response. So UI prime is, in a sense, the best that I can achieve when the others play their part of the Nash equilibrium. Okay. Now, what I can see is that all those here must be equal, and they must be equal to that. And only those for which this term here is unequal to zero. Those ui, si, comma, sigma prime minus I for which this coefficient here is zero, we just don't have to regard. Okay? Now, why is that the case? Good. So, to give you an example, let's assume the outcome is 6, yeah? And 6 is 1/3 times 6 plus 0 times something plus 2/3 times 6. We're talking about an equation that looks like this, okay? And the question is, well, couldn't we have something else here or here so that this thing is still balanced? And the answer is no, okay? Why? So, none of these values can be larger than my ui sigma prime, because otherwise we would have a violation of the Nash equilibrium condition, right? So, that's the definition of the Nash equilibrium condition. And if one of those things would be larger than this, well, it would just violate the Nash equilibrium. Yeah, I would have gone for my pure strategy SI if that would have given me a better utility, assuming that the others still stick to the Nash equilibrium, right? So this is not a Nash equilibrium then. And in the Nash equilibrium, these things cannot be larger than these. They can also not be smaller, because if they are selectively smaller, let's assume if I have a 5 here or a 4 here, so there's no way you can make this smaller such that this term is still the same. Okay? So what we know is that in essence all these pure strategy terms, utility terms, must be the same, right? And that's just exactly the indifference condition. In such a non-degenerate mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, we are indifferent between all the pure strategies that we assign positive mixing probability to, right? That's just a consequence of the Nash equilibrium. And what we will see is that we can use that to actually compute these numbers, okay? Good. Some more facts with respect to Nash equilibria. Okay. So, first fact, strict Nash equilibria do not need to exist. However, we can prove and guarantee that each finite strategy form game, so that's a game in our sense, does have a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium. Okay. Furthermore, so if these conditions hold, right, for all players and for all pure strategies alternatives, then obviously no player has an incentive to deviate from the Nash equilibrium. And that was the original definition of the first part, right? So in the first part, we said Nash equilibrium is when nobody has an incentive to deviate, assuming that the others stick to the Nash equilibrium, which kind of makes this a fixed thing. Yeah. However, as we've already seen in real life, we cannot count on strict rationality, right? Because there's psychology, moral, and all these things involved. So we can have certain deviations from that pure homo economicus type of reasoning. And if we are successful with iterated strict dominance, we would get a unique strategy profile out of this, and this unique strategy profile is then a strict Nash equilibrium, a strict unique Nash equilibrium. Okay. And what we already also saw, that in a Nash equilibrium, we're only allowed, or whatever, allowed. I mean, it's a natural consequence of the definitions, that we can only assign positive probabilities to those strategies that are not dominated. Okay? Otherwise, well, we could increase our profit by putting a bet on the more dominating strategies, right? That's only logical. Let's look at a different example, okay? So that we, in a sense, grasp what is meant by optimal response, okay? And that example is the Cournot competition, which is a duopoly, a very simple market model of two companies competing for customers, okay? And the only degree of freedom that they have is to choose their output level of some good that they produce, okay? And these output levels are chosen from a certain set of alternatives. Let's assume for the moment that they are chosen from real numbers between 0 and 1, okay? And each company has a certain cost associated with producing this amount of these amounts of goods, right? And the price is dependent on the sum of the produced goods, okay? And that's the situation we have. So if one company decides to produce very many goods, then there are very many goods on the market and the price will go down, right? If the companies choose to produce less goods, then the price would just go up. But the question is, how much goods would I produce in contrast to the other firm, right? So am I playing on, or am I betting on the alternative that I would guess I'm producing a lot of goods and the price will then be cheap for these large amounts of goods, but still I have a better gain than the company that chooses to produce a few goods, resulting in higher prices, but still they're not getting more than I do. So that's more or less the model of choosing between producing cheap products, but many, compared to choosing a few, producing a few high-priced products, right? And it's simple because we were having this simple condition here, okay? Which is maybe not true in a true market. And the profit of company I would then be the amount of goods produced times the price that they, all of the goods on the market achieve, minus the production costs. That's the income minus the things that you have to spend. And since the only degrees of freedom that we have, or the only degree is the output, the number of goods, or the respective output level of the number of goods that we produce, the question is, what is the optimal response to the other company's choice, right? And thus, we must define so-called reaction functions. So if I'm player one, my reaction to what the other company chooses will then be my choice. Yeah. So the other company chooses to do Q2, and my optimal reaction, if I put it into my reaction function R1, would then be my output Q1. And for the other company, it's just the other way around, right? So the other company would react to my choice with an optimal choice of theirs. The whole point is that this action taking is done simultaneously, as all the time in our games, okay? So, and we will see if these things are done in succession. So if the first company, for example, chooses the output levels, and in a second step, the other company chooses theirs, then we would get different Nash equilibria, right? So if they choose simultaneously, we will get a certain Nash equilibrium. And if they choose after each other, then we'll get a different one. But this is something we might not get to in this lecture. This is about multi-stage games, about dynamic games of complete information. How can we determine those reaction functions, and what is the actual Nash equilibrium? Okay, now, certainly Nash equilibria are defined with respect to maximizing utilities, as always, right? So under certain conditions, which are quite easy to meet, which we're not going to discuss, they're referenced here in the Fudenberg book, we can maximize, for example, company 2's utility function by just the usual taking the derivative and setting it equal to 0. Okay. Now, what is U2? So, the utility is the income of company 2 minus the costs that company 2 has, just as before, right? And we would have to take the derivation with respect to Q2. And that's just the result, right? And then we would have to set this to 0. Now, what does that give us? Okay, so I'm company 2, and I'm interested in maximizing my utility U2. Okay, so what I have to substitute is for my choice Q2, right? I will have to substitute that my choice Q2 is the optimal response to the other company's choice Q1. So I will just replace in that equation all the Q2 instances with R2 of Q1. Okay? That will turn this equation of two variables into an equation of one variable only, right? And this is just the implicit definition of that reaction function R2. If we're lucky, we can solve that equation for R2, and then we get something like this, that R2 is just a function of Q1, and the right side is only dependent on Q1, yeah, and no R2 symbols are in there, right? That's an explicit form of the Cournot reaction function. So Cournot competition is the name for the whole game, okay? And the same is true for the other company. Just the same type of reasoning, but you start with optimizing U1. Now, it is rather trivial to see that the Nash equilibrium occurs at the intersection of both reaction functions, because we saw that in a Nash equilibrium, each player's action is the optimal response to the other player's action in the Nash equilibrium. So in the Nash equilibrium, I don't know if it's on the slides, what we would have is that R1 of Q1 Nash is Q2 Nash is R2 of Q1 Nash. And that's an equation that may allow us to solve for Q1, Q2, which is the Nash equilibrium, okay? And we can do so, okay? So if we assume that we'd have a linear demand, meaning that the price raises if more goods are produced. Yeah, so that's a linear demand. And we also have linear costs, meaning that there is a constant cost for, let's assume, each unit produced. So the costs have that function. And if you do all the math for these assumptions, you would get that R2 of Q1 is given by that expression. And since the stuff is symmetric, R1 of Q2 is given by an analogous equation, right? And if you do the math with respect to that, you find that the Nash equilibrium is 1/3 1 minus C for both parties. Okay? That's the stuff we get. Okay, so that's that. And what do we learn from that? So in games that are structured like these, that are dependent on constant parameters, we can compute the Nash equilibrium with the help of optimal reactions. Okay, and that's just the way it is done here. Good. So let's do a second example that goes along the same lines. Okay, so it's called hoteling competition and doesn't have anything to do with actual hotels where people can stay the night, but it's the guy, I think, or is it, I don't know if it's a woman or a man, is called hoteling, if I'm not completely mistaken, right? Good. So still we have two companies. One, it is situated at a location 0. The other one is situated at a location 1. We have a unit cost for our product, and the price for the product is PI for each company. Okay, and the consumers have a location that's uniformly distributed over this interval. And what they would choose is they would choose the company for buying the good that is overall cheaper, right? And the price is determined by the goods price plus the transportation cost, okay? So let's assume, for example, this green man is nearer to the first company. So he would choose the first company's product if the sum of P1, of the price that company 1 set for the product, plus his transportation cost, is smaller than the price of company 2 plus his larger transportation costs. So if company 2 has a substantially lower price, he might nevertheless choose to go there. Right? And that's a typical situation if you buy foods, for example, and you live in the city center. Okay, so you always have the choice to go to Aldi, which is far away but cheap. But if you're lazy, you could go to Karstadt, which costs twice the price but is nearer. Right? So that's always your choice that you have. Okay. And now, what's the Nash equilibrium? Right. So the demand for company 1 would be, X in this case. And what we have is that price for company 1 plus transportation times X. So T is the constant transportation cost. And X is just the location here, somewhere between 0 and 1. Okay? Plus, that's the thing, okay? And so X is just the break-even point in this case. So let's assume the prices are different. Then we have some break-even point where people to the left will go to company 1 and to the right will go to company 2, right? And this break-even point is just computed by this equation, right? And this break-even point we will call the demand for company 1. If you solve that equation, you get this. And naturally, the demand for company 1 is 1 minus the demand for company 2, right? So there's a break-even point, and everything to the left will go to company 1, and everything to the right will here go to company 2. So if X is exactly here, this is the demand for company 1. And this is the demand for company 2. So all the persons, if we assume that they're uniformly distributed, that live to the right of this X, X would go to company 2. So in a sense, this is the demand for company 2. It's higher, maybe, yeah? Because the prices of P2 is smaller than P1. But still, we can get a good profit if we have a high price and a small demand. It's not, maybe the other company has a high demand but a small price, and it's not necessarily so that one of them is better than the other, right? Good. And now, since the degree of freedom is only the prices, what we do is we compute the Nash equilibrium. And we do so, for example, for each player, we need to maximize the gain, the utility. And that's price times demand minus costs times demand. Yeah, that's what we have to maximize. And if we do the same stuff as before, we would denote the reaction as R1 of P2 and R2 of P1. And for example, for company number 2, we would have to compute the derivation with respect to P2, because we are company 2, we want to maximize our income, and we have the only degree of freedom of choosing an optimal P2. So d to the dp2 of this must be 0. And then afterwards, if we have this equation, if we did the derivation, we have to replace all the instances of P2 with R2 of P1. Just the same as in the Cournot case. And here, in this case, you can do the math, and this is the result. Yeah, so I would leave that up to you as an exercise to actually do the proper math. Good. Now, more examples, and more examples that kind of make it clear, or show some special cases that might happen. So, first of all, are there games that do not have a pure Nash equilibrium? Okay. Good. So first of all, there is the case this is the whole chapter, right? So first of all, what irritates us is that some games may have more than one pure strategy Nash equilibrium. And then, if we have more than one, it's not so clear what would happen. If we only have one, as in the prisoner's dilemma, okay, it's clear. They're going to defect. But if we have more than one, it's not so clear. Let's inspect a game, and that's the matching pennies game. Right? Both players toss a coin, and if heads or tails of the two coins match, then the first player would win, and if the heads or tails of the two tosses, or the individual tosses, would differ, then player two wins. And that's just respected in this payoff matrix. Yeah, so matching head-head would make player one game win, player one win. A tail-tail would make player one win. So a match is this, a difference would make the other player win. No, what we see is that there is no pure Nash equilibrium here, okay, but there is a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, and that's just if they completely randomize their actions, okay? And, well, the degrees of freedom are not just tossing the coin, but guessing head or tail in beforehand, right? And if they completely randomize, that's a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium. Okay. Why is that the case? Let's assume player two plays this mixed strategy. One half, one half. What we get is that player's one expected payoff is, okay, what would happen? So player two is this, one half, one half. So the expected payoff for player one is, if he or she chooses heads, it's one half times one plus one half times minus one, that's zero. And if he or she chooses tails, it's just the same, minus one times one half plus one half times one. Okay? So player one is, in a sense, indifferent. Yeah? That's what the indifference condition actually is. And if you do the reasoning starting from player one, you would just get the same. Yeah, so the expected payoff for the other player is zero in all the cases. So we can do no better then stick to that strategy. All the pure strategy alternatives are not better than that. Let's do something a bit more realistic than that. And that's the inspection game. Okay? Good. What's the inspection game? Okay, good. We have two parties, a worker and an employer. And the employer has the chances to inspect the worker or not inspect the worker, whereas the worker has the chance to actually work or stay lazy and hope the best. Okay? So shirking means stay lazy, hope the best. Working means, yeah, do your job. Now, the worker has some costs associated with working. It causes him pain and he would have to just do something. But when he works, he produces a value V. And if he works, he gets a wage W. Okay? And the employer has costs for the inspection that we denote with H. Okay? So for the moment, we assume W is larger than G, G is larger than H, and they're all positive. Okay? Now, what will happen? So if the worker shirks and the inspector inspects, what the worker gets is just nothing. I'm not going to pay you something, you shirker. But this costs the inspector minus H, right? So he has to go to the assembly hall, has to hide behind a column and see what the guy or girl is doing, and that costs him H. Now, if the worker shirks and the inspector does not inspect, the worker gets paid normally, and the inspector does not have any value, right? There is no value produced, and the only thing is he has a loss because he pays the shirking worker minus, he pays him W, so that's his loss minus W. If the worker works, he has a benefit of W minus G. Yeah, he earns W but has to spend G. And inspector has, if he inspects, he has the value that the guy produces or the girl minus the wage that he has to pay minus the inspection costs. Yeah, because he inspected the guy, he found him working, that's okay, he has to pay him W, but he also has the value. If he doesn't inspect, he has just the same without the inspection costs. Okay, and that's the game. It's dependent on certain parameters. Okay. Now, we don't have a pure Nash equilibrium. Why? So, if the worker shirks, then it's rational on behalf of the employer to inspect. If the employer inspects, it's only rational for the worker to work. If the worker works, it's not rational to inspect anymore, and so on and so on. That's not a formal proof, but it kind of illustrates that there is actually no pure Nash equilibrium. Whatever you do, the other alternative would have been better. So let's inspect the case where the employer randomizes, if we have a mixed strategy equilibrium. Now, once again, the worker is the first player and the inspector the second player. The worker randomizes with probability x 1 minus x, so x 1 minus x, and the employer randomizes with y 1 minus y. Now, this is the first instance where we use the indifference condition to actually compute the respective numbers. So, in a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, we said that was that on the other board, the worker must be indifferent between S and W. Okay? If the worker still had a preference for one, then it couldn't be a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, a true mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, right? So here we made ourselves clear that in that mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, all the alternatives that he assigns positive probability to must be the same for him. He must be indifferent. Okay? So the worker must be indifferent between shirking and working. So how can we compute that? Okay. Now, the gains of the worker are 0, W, W minus G, and W minus G. Okay? And let's inspect what happens if the employer plays this mixed strategy. Okay? So my expected gain of shirking is 0 times Y plus W times 1 minus Y. That's this right side. My gain from working is W minus G times Y plus W minus G times 1 minus Y. That's this here, okay? And these two must be equal, okay? That's the worker being indifferent between shirking and working. And if you solve that equation, you would find G to be equal to W times V. Or in other words, the gain from shirking, which is just you as a worker not having to spend your efforts in working, this G, must be equal to the expected income loss, which is just the probability that the employer inspects, and that's why, times the income W, because if he or she inspects and finds me shirking, I would lose all my wages. And that happens with the probability of Y, right? And that allows us to determine Y as G over W. And the indifference condition must also be true in the Nash equilibrium for the employer. So if the worker randomizes with X, 1 minus X, the employer must be indifferent between I and NI. Okay, so once again, what is the gain of the utility for I? So it is minus H times X plus V minus W minus H times 1 minus X. That's exactly the right side. And the left side would be X times minus W plus 1 minus X times V minus W, right? And we can solve that and find that H is equal to X times W. And that's nothing but stating that the inspection costs must be the same as the expected wage savings. Yeah? These are my savings in wage or payment for the worker. And this must be equal to my inspection costs. And that's this balance, that's this equilibrium, right? If both parties are indifferent, meaning, well, their utility, whatever the other does, it is like that. And if this is true for all the players, then this is a mixed strategy Nash equilibrium, which by implicates that the indifference condition holds, right? So if the indifference condition holds, we're having a Nash equilibrium and the other way around. So this is important because it's a typical exam question that might arise. You're having a game, use this very simple indifference condition to compute the mixing probabilities. Yeah, it's only simple. Good, we'll leave that out, okay, for the moment because we're already far in time. Another example, battle of the sexes, right? So the story is man and woman, and they decide upon their evening program. The man wants to watch the football game, the woman wants to go to the opera, okay? Cliche as cliche can be. Maybe today things are the other way around. I don't know. I don't care. It's not my example. It's from the book, right? And what happens if the man, let's assume this player, the first player is the man and this is the second player. If the man insists on football and the woman chooses ballet, then they're going to have an argument and they're going to be in bad mood. So the payoff is zero. And the other way around, if the man chooses ballet and the woman chooses football, well, they agree, but they would both sit there like, okay, this is certainly not what I wanted, okay? And if they choose according to cliché, right, the man insists on football and the woman says, oh, yes, okay, I love you so much, okay, maybe football, okay? Then the man says, and the woman says, well, at least he's not going to argue with me, right? And the other way around. Man agrees to ballet, woman insists on ballet, and maybe the man likes it a little bit, and the woman is well off. As I said, it's very sexist and cliché, but this is the example. And the same is true for, well, not the same. Another game is the game of chicken. That is the one we also discussed. Staying in line or steering away has roughly a comparable structure, maybe. Now, what is the Nash equilibrium in the battle of the sexes? Okay, so indifference condition. So the first player is this one, and the second player is this one. And the randomizing probability of the first player choosing F is X. And so what we're having here, if this is the first player, and we're having F and B, and oops, B and F, right? Okay, then the first player, player one, player two, and this one randomizes with X1 minus X, just to be sure. Yes. And the other one randomizes with Y and 1 minus Y, right? Just to have it symmetrically, right? So the indifference of player 1 means I will have to regard player 2's mixing probability. So to be indifferent between this F and this B, we must have that 0 times Y plus 2 times 1 minus y, right side, will be the same as 1 times y plus 0 times 1 minus y. Same stuff. So the first player's indifference gives us the second player's mixing strategy, right? That's this reaction type of function. So in order to leave the first player indifferent, I, as the second player, must play Y as two-third. And player 2's indifference gives us that X is two-third as well, so the mixed Nash equilibrium would be that. And you can do the same for the game of chicken, leading to this mixed strategy, Nash equilibrium. Okay? Good. So we saw that some games have more than one Nash equilibrium. So which of these Nash equilibria will actually be chosen? Now, in general, you cannot say anything about that, but there is something like a focalness of Nash equilibria. So, for example, if the game is to choose for the players to choose some time of the day at random, and you get a reward if there is a match. So the strategy of choosing 37 minutes past 3 is certainly not rational, whereas choosing, let's say, 6 p.m. or 12 a.m. noon is somehow more rational, but that's just because of psychology, right? So there may be Nash equilibria that are more focal than others, right? But that's just a side aspect. Other side aspect, so risk dominance. If we regard the stag hunt game that we discussed, we have two strict Nash equilibria. Go for the go for the stag, or go for the hare, right? However, going for the stag is gives us a higher reward than going for the hare. So we might assume that people would actually choose to cooperate and hunt the larger animal. Okay? But if we assume that, CC, we might choose if we assume that the probability of choosing C is larger than 0.5. If we have more than two players, we have the situation that all must agree on hunting the stag. If we have five players, we actually need five to bring the animal down, right? So this is more risky because we have to have that P of C to the power 8 must be larger than 0.5, right? And so DD, going for the hare, which I can do individually, right? And I get the hare, is more, it's risk dominant in a certain way. That's just another very simple example for this theory of risk dominance, which also is reflected in this example with the minus 100 suckers payoff thing. Okay? Good. Okay, good. There's more things here. Let me, if you allow me to do only those two slides, then we're basically done, and I will leave out all the rest of the exam as well, right? So let's, give me just five more minutes to do this, okay? So, what also happens is that in this game, for example, we have UL and DR as pure Nash equilibria, and again, 9-9 is larger than 7-7, so UL, as we say, Pareto dominates DR, right? However, for player 1, D is in a sense safer, because whatever the other does, here I'm getting only 1 less, but here I'm getting 7 less, so it's safer, right? And this is something we already had in this minus 100 example here. So if I assume that the probability of playing R, of deviating from the actual rational choice, is larger than 1/8, I should not go for this Nash equilibrium, but for this one, because it is safer, in a sense. However, we could say, okay, well, why not let the players communicate? Why not let them communicate before the game and say, come on, it's only rational, let's agree on UL, you see it's two more than DR. Yeah. The question is, does that change anything? And the answer is no. Because whatever player 2 or player 1 tells, right, player 2 can gain if player 2 plays you, right? Because if he plays you, I would have 9 or 8 compared to 0 or 7. So I will always tell that I'm playing L, no matter what I really intend. So this pre-game communication is absolutely worthless. It just doesn't change anything. So there is the only, we have to differentiate. So as humans, we would say, well, pre-game communication is good because I can look him in the eye and estimate what happens. But that's not logical, right? So if you don't see the other person and are just communicated his utterances, it's of no real use, right? Last example. So here we have a three-player game. Okay, so the first player chooses A or B, and then the second player chooses U or D, and the last one L or R. Okay. Now, without a proof, we have two pure Nash equilibria, ULA and DRB. Yeah? This and this. Okay? We also have a mixed one, doesn't matter here, right? However, what we see is that ULA dominates DRB, right? So all the gains are larger in UL and A, right? Now, what will happen is the first one will choose A, second one U, third one L. So that's the rational choice. However, once player 1 has chosen, we have a two-player game in essence, right? And in that pure two-player game, we see that DR is Pareto dominant compared to UL. Here 0-0 and here 1-1, right? So if the players 1 and 2 expect the first one to choose A, what they can attempt is to coordinate on DR, right? And once again, strict rationality wouldn't change anything. The three would choose ULA, period, if they're only rational. But if there is things going on like possible coalitions, yeah, so that the players 2 and 3, right, so I mixed it up. So I always said that the first one would choose the matrix and the other ones would choose rows and columns. Here, player 3 chooses the matrix. Okay, however, players this and this, if they make a coalition, right, they could try to focus on DR. And so there is something like coalition proof equilibria. There's also a large theory on that. And this is always the case when we regard deviations from strict rationality. Okay, so what would have happened in the rest of the lecture if I had had time? We might have analyzed 2x2 games in general. Okay, this is just the general thing. These are all variables, and what would happen, right? What are the mixed strategy Nash equilibria, what are the Prior equilibria? If you want, you can look that through, but it's not part of the exam. And what will turn out is that we get an optimal reaction function, so Q1 and Q2 in this case, right, that somehow looks like this, yeah, and the other one has something that looks like this, the same, right? Oh. Evil. Good. But as you see, this is truly the case here. These are functions like that, and the other one looks just the same. And the last part, if you want, is about dynamic games. So it's the difference between the Cournot equilibrium, where both companies choose at the same time, compared to the first company chooses and then the second one reacts. If you want to see what's happening there, this is this part, but also not part of the exam. Okay, so exam fact sheet is coming out today, right? And next week on Tuesday we will have the question time, and on Wednesday there will be no lecture. So since I know, and that's especially for those out there on their radio devices, since I know that none of you has already prepared the stuff, yeah, I do not expect many questions to actually occur on Tuesday. So what I expect is that there will be two people, it will take us 10 minutes, and then everybody's gone. However, what I expect that at the end of July, you might have questions. So what I can offer you is a second question time, let's say 3 or 2 days before the exam, and then we'd just repeat the same stuff here in that lecture hall, and maybe then you're better prepared. I have complete understanding, so you only have to be rational, right? If you want that, please communicate it to me, for example, via your Semestersprechers, and then we'll find a date for that. So, for most of you, have a nice time. Thanks for listening to the lecture, and for those few that will occur, which will show up on Tuesday, you're welcome with your questions. Yeah. So, for the rest, see you on the exam date, right? Bye.